Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mornings for a typical Chinese worker. Grab a cup of tea, make your way into work. Back outside for calisthenics, then hustle into formation for the staff meeting. Face front, uniform on, and listen up.
您好，欢迎光临。您好，欢迎光临。
Say hello to Chinese business culture. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Marketplace China reports are supported by Best Buy, building a global network to help enrich lives through technology, innovation, and opportunity. Best Buy.
Live from Chongqing in the People's Republic of China, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday morning over here, still Thursday, January the 19th for you. I mentioned the other day that this might be the biggest city you've never heard of. Let me introduce you to what might be the biggest company you've never heard of. Half an hour outside downtown Chongqing, you will find the factories of the Lifan Industrial Group. Look at the buildings up high near the roofline, and you'll see red-painted Chinese characters 4 feet tall. Slogans like, to develop creatively is the only way to develop. Lifan is the biggest seller of motorcycles in China. Just last month, it started making cars, too. Down on the factory floor, this 18-year-old worker attaches window seals to a door frame.
一个多月，一千呢。
He started work a month ago, just after he got out of his vocational high school. The job is fine, he says.
还可以吧。还可以吧？为什么就是还可以？因为这怎么说呢？
But mostly he works because he's 18 now, and he should contribute to his family.
每个月的收入是多少？七百。七百块。
He makes 700 kuai a month, $87.50, and sends almost half of it home because he should. That's just the way it's done here. China is, in many ways, still a traditional place, full of personal and professional obligations. Any Western executive realizes pretty quickly there are some rules to keep in mind. Late nights and loud carousing are part of the bargain. When you hand your business card to someone, hold it by the corners with both hands. That shows respect. And this one, the more you think you know about business culture in China, the less you really do, even if you were born here. Marketplace's Jocelyn Ford has more.
It's 7:30 a.m. and Zhang He is driving to work in foggy, smoggy Chongqing. A car swerves over the yellow line into our lane and gets back just in time to avoid a collision.
People are impatient. Wait.
At the office, he multitasks at a mind-boggling rate.
Hold on a second, I got another phone call. Wait.
This morning, he's juggling an in-person meeting with his marketing officer, two phone calls, and five online conversations, all while being a father on Skype internet phone to his 12-year-old son, who lives in the United States.
So, are you onto your computer game?
Yeah. Zhang He is what the Chinese call a sea turtle, Chinese who study or work overseas and later return to seek their fortune. The Chinese government wants them to come home. They're helping catapult the country into the global economy by bringing back technology and management know-how.
So this is a big machine that cost us 1.5 million Chinese yuan.
Zhang's company, Frontier Biotechnologies, is working on cutting-edge, inexpensive treatments for AIDS patients. Back in the late 1990s, Zhang quit a prestigious job as a researcher at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. He wanted to do something that would immediately save lives, so he launched a biotech startup. But he soon discovered in the U.S., researchers' salaries are too expensive. So 6 years ago, he came back to check out China.
Everybody was talking about market economy, doing business, making money.
The local government in Chongqing offered him low-cost offices. It helped arrange a partnership with a state-run pharmaceutical company that promised research funds. But he soon discovered the business skills he acquired living in the West were out of sync with his Chinese partners. He was used to people being direct and to following laws and regulations. In China, that doesn't get you very far. Oftentimes, people don't keep their word. For example, a state-owned company that promised him research money reneged when new management came in.
And all of a sudden, they said, no, we don't want to do it anymore. People I know all left. The new faces, the new people come, and they had their own plan.
Even though he had a contract, the company ignored it. State-owned companies can get away with that because the state also controls the court system. Friends of his offered advice. They suggested he play by Chinese rules.
After they invested you the money, you should give them some kickbacks to the key persons. Until today, I still didn't want to believe that this was the reason that they stopped the program.
Zhang didn't give up on China. He started over with a new company of his own and stuck to his principles. But it was often confusing figuring out how to get through the maze of bureaucracy. There are no clear rules on how to get things done. He found that out when he applied for his business license.
For example, after we renovate the labs, we need a stamp from fire department. And we never heard anything from them 2 weeks after. And then I realized I had to invite them for lunch. So I did so, and here you go. You're stamped. Forms here. You're approved.
Zhang says kickbacks aren't always the clincher. Local officials want to be treated with respect, and they want to know what's in the deal for them. So he implied if they play it clean, it'll help the city's reputation, and other high-tech companies might also come to invest. Zhang's Western-style management also plays well with his employees. During lunch break, he sometimes plays ping-pong with researchers and staff. Receptionist Liu Sha says she's surprised Zhang is so approachable. In Chinese companies, she says, the boss is like an emperor, and no one dares point out problems.
In the company I worked before, the boss is boss, staff is staff. But here is good, yeah.
Zhang is finally benefiting from all his effort to bridge the differences between China and the West. He has a business partner in the U.S. who works on sophisticated research that can't be done in China. Zhang expects by working the strengths of both sides of the Pacific, the company can save 2 to 4 years in bringing the product to market. The hardest part of his life, he says, is being so far away from his wife and 2 teenage kids who still live in Maryland.
That's all the cool kids do.
Go to bed early, okay? Go to bed early.
Zhang doubts his kids, who've grown up in the U.S., could survive in China. Chinese school kids study all the time. In Chongqing, I'm Jocelyn Ford for Marketplace.
American companies have flooded into China over the past decade. 400 of the global Fortune 500 companies have operations here. Both Intel and Ford have major plants right here in Chongqing. That despite China's reputation for being the wild, wild east of the business world. I wanted to get a handle on China's reputation for lawlessness, so I turned to Ted Fishman. He's the author of a book called China Inc., but it's the subtitle that gives it away, How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World.
For the last 100 years, there's been no more tumultuous place than China. They've had the end of a dynastic realm, a budding democracy, a civil war, world war, famine, a communist regime which has reinvented itself several times. And the people in China, if they at any point in that time decided they were going to follow the government dictates and take seriously the rule of law, 2 years later would be told that the law was no good and, in fact, they were doing wrong. So the standards of business that have grown up there, by necessity, really rely on things that exist outside the law.
Well, let's run through a hypothetical here. I mean, an American executive goes over there, goes out for dinner with some new Chinese colleagues. They have a couple of drinks, and then it escalates from there to what? Sort of talking about how to do business and skirt around the rules? I mean, how does this typically happen?
Well, provided you're sober when it escalates, what you're learning there is everything is always negotiable. Contracts exist on those relationships, not necessarily on the kinds of protections you can get from a court system after they're signed.
There is a loss of moral compass, I guess, that we're sort of talking about here. Does that loss come after companies go to China and don't succeed and realize they have to do it the Chinese way? Or does it happen before they go and they surrender right away?
It begins with the decision to go. And often the decision is not something that's simply a choice. In a competitive landscape, you're forced to go. And when you're forced to go, you go reluctantly because you know you're going to have to change your business standards. Now, you know, the United States has a law that prohibits companies from bribing. And yet now there is a lobbying effort in the United States to free companies from some of the demands of that law.
Are we talking bribes? Are we talking cash? Or are we talking skirting OSHA requirements, if they had OSHA requirements in China?
Everything. We're talking, you know, any kind of corner that can be cut with a check or an envelope of cash, or even with a job to the son of a executive or party official. It's nothing new in China. It's the scale of what's going on there and how it affects American industry up and down. The vast migration of American companies to China is all informed by these practices.
It's kind of funny that you say that companies go over there and badmouth the U.S. government. You might think there would be some loyalty to the economic system that gave them their start.
Companies now, even if they were identified with the United States, part of the American mythos, now are recasting themselves as global companies. So if you listen to an American CEO today, he doesn't say, I'm the leader of an American company. He says, I'm a leader of a global company. China is very important to us. People say I'm outsourcing jobs to China, but what I'm really doing is I'm insourcing them to China. And we are going to go to the countries in the world that give us the best policies to run our business. And that is part of my global mission. In fact, I owe it to my shareholders.
It's all for the good of the shareholders, then.
It sticks in your craw because lots of these companies only exist because of the atmosphere that they grew up in the United States, which was rule of law, protection of the workers, protection of their intellectual property. So when they start recasting themselves as a global CEO, you wonder about their core commitment to the place which made their business possible.
Ted Fishman is the author of quite a few books about China, including China Inc. and The Chinese Century. You've heard about the piracy in China. Counterfeit DVDs hit the streets here almost as soon as the real thing hits movie theaters in the U.S. I can get you a great deal on a Rolex watch if you want. Western companies and the U.S. government spend a good amount of time and energy trying to convince Beijing to crack down on intellectual property rights. But commentator and filmmaker Hao Wu says if not for piracy, China would be a very different place.
In China, I hear all kinds of pro-piracy arguments. Some argue that in a country where the average annual income is around $1,000, legal Hollywood DVDs are simply too expensive. Or there's the quality of life argument, that without piracy, entertainment options will be reduced to bland Chinese television, anemic domestic movie productions, and the 20 blockbuster movies imported from overseas every year. I'm a documentary filmmaker, so my argument's different. Truth is, I need pirated DVDs to keep up with the latest in the industry. China has no blockbuster, Netflix, or a meaningful public library system. Without piracy, I've never seen the likes of Inside Deep Throat, Super Size Me, or The Grizzly Man. In a country where media is still tightly controlled by the government, piracy seems the only way for unfettered information access other than the internet. Still, I'm willing to pay a little extra for the legit stuff, or at least I was. Last year, when Warner Brothers lowered the price of some DVDs in China to $3, I bought a copy of Batman Begins, but there were no DVD extras or even language selection, and Chinese censors had cut short a scene in which a woman's dress fell off her shoulder. I didn't care about the bare shoulder of the beautiful actress, but I've decided to stick with piracy for a while. If we had access only to legal media products that have passed the censors, we would be stuck with the likes of Titanic, Backstreet Boys, and Batman with no shoulder exposed, products as mind-numbing as the communist propaganda. So maybe Hollywood should stop being so afraid of piracy in China. Maybe corporate profits could take a back seat for a while in the name of the grand ideal of promoting democracy and open societies all over the world. When China has become truly open and the economy has improved for all of its population, not just the lucky few, then Hollywood can easily come in and reap billions more in rewards.
Documentary filmmaker Hao Wu lives in Beijing. Did his defense of piracy win you over? And what about U.S. businesses in China? Should they bend their principles to succeed? We'd like to know what you think about today's program. You can go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Coming up, making it up as you go along.
We love that you can march into a city and say, I've got a great idea that you guys have never heard of, and I've probably only just made up myself, but you know, we're going to give it a shot.
But first, let's do the numbers. China's surge in new business is increasingly homegrown. State figures say private businesses now outnumber those owned by the government or by foreign companies. Chinese entrepreneurs own 3.9 million companies. That's a bit more than half the going concerns here. Foreign companies invested $60 billion in China in 2005, and they've invested $1 billion every week since China joined the World Trade Organization 5 years ago. The Dow added 25 points today, 0.25% to close at 10,880. The Nasdaq gained 22 points, almost 1%. The Shanghai Composite Index gained 18 points. That's a traditional Chinese flute playing the happy music. You are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace China reports are supported by Best Buy, building a global network to help enrich lives through technology, innovation, and opportunity. Best Buy. Marketplace is broadcasting live from China all this week. If you want to find out more, drop by our website. You'll find exclusive online features, including slideshows, a staff blog, and an interview with the musicians who created the Chinese version of our theme music. It's all at www.marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the special China edition of the Marketplace Datebook. In June 2000, the Chinese equivalent of Google made its debut. Baidu.com was the first company to offer searches in Chinese. Its success is credited to Baidu's understanding of the complexity of Chinese characters. Pinpointing queries is an art in a language where I can be said 38 different ways. The word Baidu means hundreds of times. It represents a persistent search for the ideal. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal, and we are live all this week from the 56th floor of the World Trade Center here in beautiful downtown Chongqing, China. The headline in the China Daily today comes out of a bird flu conference up in Beijing. Donor countries have pledged nearly $2 billion. They say they will give six Asian countries first dibs. China is on that list. Back in Washington, the bureaucracies that distribute foreign aid have announced they're going to streamline bureaucracy. The new rules will give Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice more flexibility in how that money is spent, but it could mean less aid for countries that don't fit into the war on terror, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
With apologies to the DMV, the U.S. foreign aid machine works a bit like, well, the DMV. So many agencies are involved in everything from fighting drugs to fighting infant mortality that big picture goals can get lost. Today's State Department plan consolidates all the programs inside the U.S. Agency for International Development. That way, if Washington sees a red flag in the world, it can respond without the red tape. State Department alum Stuart Patrick.
In the case of Iraq, for instance, if the United States is attempting to get a lot of money very quickly, this will enhance the ability of the Secretary of State to do that.
But in a tight budget environment, George Rupp, head of the nonprofit International Rescue Committee, worries geopolitical concerns will trump others, like anti-poverty programs.
Those parts of the world that do not figure prominently in U.S. foreign policy considerations could very easily be shortchanged.
Some say that shortchanging already occurs. Allies Israel and Egypt top the list of foreign aid recipients. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The daily AIDS cocktail might soon be reduced to a single pill. Bristol Myers and Gilead Sciences say they will combine three of their most popular antiretroviral drugs that AIDS patients usually take together. A report in the New England Journal of Medicine today calls that pill the best in class, and the companies expect to file an application with the FDA later this spring. Helen Palmer reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH.
A decade ago, AIDS patients had to take a dozen or more pills a day to keep the virus in check. One pill once a day will help them stay healthier. But this collaboration isn't just a breakthrough for patient health, says Michael Weinstein of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation.
We've been a prisoner of the individual patent interests of the companies.
No one company owns all the patents to any successful three-drug cocktail. Weinstein says this cooperation will boost the company's public image. This therapy combines the three most prescribed drugs, Bristol-Myers Sustiva, with Gilead's Viread and Emtriva, and it'll be a blockbuster.
The Gilead portion of the revenues from this combination will be somewhere north of $2.2 billion.
SG Cowan analyst Phil Nadeau. The combo will cost about the same as the multi-pill cocktail, he says, but patients will get a price break.
The public only have to pay one copay. That's why it's modestly cheaper.
Neither Gilead nor Bristol-Myers would talk about U.S. pricing, but they hope to offer the drug at cost to the 40 million AIDS patients in the developing world. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
And this is Marketplace, live from Chongqing, China. Back when I was living in Beijing, there was this thing that used to happen. I'd say something in pretty good Chinese, maybe to a waitress, and she'd look right back at me and say, in Chinese, "I'm sorry, I don't speak English," almost as if she couldn't believe her language was coming out of my Western face. That doesn't happen much anymore, not because my Chinese is any better, but because there are so many more Westerners here. And that's taken some of the rough edges off living in China. But Marketplace's Nate DeMeo found some Westerners in Shanghai who are a little wistful.
One night a month, the place to be for Shanghai expats in the know is upstairs at a one-time electronics factory, now Fusion Restaurant. On this night, a couple of dozen chic Westerners sip cocktails, smoke cigarettes, and generally look cool while listening to people talking about real estate.
Renovation is really the key here to maximizing your returns on property.
That's Scott Barrick. He runs a company that sells and leases properties from Shanghai's colonial past. Business has been very good for the past few years. Wealthy expats often spend more than $1 million for the houses he sells. Life these days is nice and laid back. Maybe too laid back.
I'd always wanted to work overseas. I thought the idea of speaking another language and being a businessman at the same time was very James Bond-ish.
For several years, it sort of was. In 1996, he came to China as a college kid. He didn't know anyone. He didn't speak the language. It was hard and scary, and he loved it. Classes ended, and he didn't leave. He got a job with a company in northern China that made a Tootsie Roll knockoff called Cowboy Candy. They were happy to have a square-jawed Coloradan who could fill a 10-gallon hat and flash an American smile at trade fairs and sales meetings. He found the work fascinating. But the cities he visited were bleak and gray, until he hit Shanghai.
Shanghai was just lights. I was just blown away at how bright it was. Massive skyscrapers, just very intense, almost too intense to take in. You could just feel the momentum pushing it.
He was hooked. He ditched the cowboy hat and moved to Shanghai.
I fell in really quite quickly with a really good group of young expatriates all doing their own thing. And so it was a blast. Everybody was experiencing the same things together, going through the same troubles. We were all loving it. Everybody was just enthralled with the speed of what was going on.
The place was literally exploding around our ears.
Mark Kiddo was one of those early expatriates.
Everything was happening all at once. The kind of progress that takes hundreds of years in established cities or metropolises in the world. In Shanghai, it was all happening at once. The speed, the ferocity of change in the place was incredible.
Kiddo went from commodity trader to cub reporter to publisher of a mini empire of successful magazines, all within a matter of months. Just a few years later, he had lost it all and launched into a seemingly Sisyphean legal struggle with the Chinese government. But that's a story for another day.
At that time, money was flowing really, really stupidly.
Adrian Cortez touched down in Shanghai in that same heady period of the late 90s. This was just as the city's now famous skyscrapers were rising on the backs of a flood of international capital and Chinese government investment. Anything seemed possible.
This was like being in on the ground floor of New York or something.
And everybody wanted in. The city began to change. It seemed like every multinational wanted to add China to its multiple nations and raise a corporate flag over Shanghai. A new type of expat started to arrive. torrents of expense account wielding middle managers flooded in.
There's a lack of love, I think, in some sense, on for what they're doing. And it is more of a, I don't want to say rape and pillage, but it's come, take what you can get. The Chinese are there right now to suit your needs and bolts.
That's Scott Barrick again. He says his crowd came to experience China. They wanted to be involved in the life of the city and the story of a changing country.
I would take a massive pay cut to go back to the good old days.
Meanwhile, Mark Kiddo, in the far corner of his sprawling 1920s apartment, the door closed so as not to disturb his two small sleeping children, says he doesn't have time for nostalgia.
That's part of the painful process of growing up. But you have to grow up, and all of us who are playing like kids on the playground, we appreciate the fact that the quality of life has definitely improved. I remember discussing with a friend who was saying, you know, we used to be able to just, you know, we'd all go to a bar and we'd all be there. Well, that was because there was only one bar. And now there's hundreds. What do you expect? Of course it's going to change.
The city, it seems, has grown up too. The business culture has become more sophisticated. The time when Westerners could wow their way into a job just by virtue of being a Westerner is long gone. The days of the Wild Wild West may be over in Shanghai. But Kiddo says that you can still find them in other parts of China. You just have to go west, to cities like Chongqing. There, an adventurous expat can still feel the thrill of the pioneer life and still make the rules up as he or she goes along.
That's one of the reasons that oddballs, people like me and my friends, come to China, is because you can do that sort of stuff. We love that. You can march into a city and say, I've got a great idea that you guys have never heard of, and I've probably only just made up myself, but you know, we're going to give it a shot. And if you believe in it, it's amazing what you can achieve in this country.
In Shanghai, I'm Nate DeMeo for Marketplace.
If you've missed any of our special China coverage this week, you can download MP3s of all of our broadcasts. Just go to our website. It's marketplace.org. We've done an extra edition of our podcast, too.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
One final example of adapting to China's business culture? You're listening to it. We started planning this week's shows 7 months ago. We hired a Chinese producer to help us navigate the bureaucracy. But still, there were endless rounds of discussions over where we would do our broadcasts from, where our reporters would go, and how closely our minders would watch us. City governments in Shanghai and here in Chongqing had to approve. The central government in Beijing, too. So there was paperwork to be done just right. Over here, if it's an official document, it needs a Chinese stamp, a chop. Never mind that we don't use them in the States. We hosted dinners, paid fees, and paid again. And after all that, 7 months of planning, I didn't get my visa until 4 hours before my plane left for Shanghai. That is China. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Our editors include Peter Clowney, Nate DeMeo, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Julie Small, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, should we be afraid? Live in Chongqing, I'm Kai Rizdal. Xie xie nimen. Thanks for being with us. That's American Public Media, by the way.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.